Hold on, I'm just I just clicked broadcast just now, so we are live. We're actually starting about, I don't know, 4 or 5 minutes early. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Unspun, episode number 68. And today we're joined by Clint Richardson, as well as Jacob Duhlman. Clint, I'm excited to have you here. Jacob, excited to have you back. Clint has been doing a bunch of cool work on a new book. Clint, what's the title of your book?
Straw Man, the Real Story of Your Artificial Person.
And let's see. So, you know, I wanted to have Clint on to start laying out some of that. I'm trying to talk Clint into maybe doing a series about all of that. And so I think way back in the day, I was the first or second host to ever have Clint on. I think maybe the second. I think Deanna Spingola was the first. I think she beat me by like 5 days or something like that. But, you know, Clint, we brought out a lot of the CAFR information on the show way back in the day, and Clint's been on, I don't know, probably 10, 15 times at least. So it's great to have you back, Clint, and so welcome. And Jacob, good to have you back. We've been continuing this saga. Jacob's found amazing discoveries in the last week. He's just so excited about a lot of the research, wants to participate and contribute to today's show. I think Jacob's going to add a lot to the discussion of what Clint has discovered. But we were all sitting here talking for the last 10 minutes, and we had such nice meaty treats, we figured we better just start broadcasting and share it with the audience. So, you know, I'm just going to pass it back over to Clint right now and let you go for a few minutes there, Clint.
Well, he was reading to us a passage from a new book he got, going back to, the period of time that you're talking about.
Well, why don't we back up, because then it sounds awkward to you. I didn't mean to throw it to you like that. So Jacob was reading a passage from Professor Isaac Israel Galantz.
Yeah, Allegory and Mysticism in Shakespeare by Professor Sir Israel Galantz.
Basically, what is it? The introduction of the book lays it all out and compares it all to Shakespeare and everything.
It's the first lecture that is in the book.
Gotcha.
To the Jewish Historical Society, and it's about Shylock, and it kind of details the strategies that early rulers in the church used to use to better humanity by getting them to align to their viewpoints and make them intelligent. So what I was doing was reading a passage that really detailed that. It's kind of lengthy, probably too much for our show, but Jan said that we'll do that another time and share it. So Clint was trying to do was kind of relate to that imagery of the king kind of passing down this information or power in general. And I think that's where we kind of left off.
Right. So you want to go into that, Clint? Because I was really liking that. That's why I thought we should share right then.
Well, you're talking about the most important part of magic is the visual aid. Visual things are the most important trick when it comes to the magic. That's why Hollywood is so damn important, you know, the Hollywood being the most sacred, tree of witchcraft is Hollywood. And it's why Harry Potter's wand is made out of
the wood of the holly.
Right. She didn't do that on accident. And also, she used a lot of terms from the legal language to describe, for instance, the Patronus, which is means attorney, and the Dementors and all these different things that are all part of the magic spelling that is the legal language, right? And that legal language or that figurative type of language carries over into the the old romantic languages where it was Manly P. Hall, I believe, who did a speech on how we should always strive to speak beautifully in verse, because verse is the language of the gods. Verse meaning poetry or metaphoric type of speech, personification, anthropomorphization, all of these things. And that is really, when you're talking about taking the Bible stories and putting them into plays or taking the stories of kings, some of Shakespeare's stuff, and putting it into plays and acting it out in front of the people, that's not that different than the Indian chief telling the allegory of the Great Wolf, or, right? All these stories are designed specifically to teach a story. Now, whether that story is a moral story to teach the moral law, or the natural law, if you will, or it's designed to mislead and take you away from the natural law, that's where you have to sort of look, and you have to say, so what am I looking at here? Am I looking at an apology? You know, when I'm talking about the story, the personification factor of taking a thing like money and making it into a man so that you can understand money through the notion of a personified character, right? And that's how all the ancient authors wrote. It's you know, from Plato to Plato's Republic with the democratic man and the timocratic man and the tyrannical man. Those weren't real men, obviously. They're characters that represent a specific concept that you can follow and you can tell a story about. You can say, if I'm the democratic man, I'm going to do this stupid thing, and that path is going to lead me to the next logical, reasonable place, the only place I can go from democracy, which is the worst state you can be in a society, which is tyranny. And from tyranny, back to the idealistic, you know, religious experience of having an aristocracy. And then straight from aristocracy down to the next level, because that can never last. The point is, you have to decide, is this story an apology? Are you listening to an apologist, like someone who's trying to justify the Catholic Church, which is completely against the Bible? Are you listening to an apologue, a fable, a moral fable, which is an untruth told to teach some type of thing? Is it a probability? Is it a syllogism? Is it a form of reasoning or argument, right, that you have to follow the premises in order to get to the answer? Is it a fable? Is it a parable? Is it an allegory? Is it a metaphor? Is it an aphorism, which is a maxim, like a maxim of law that we use all the time in our legal system? And of course, the maxims of law are there, and they're taken from the Bible, which is the natural law personified into the character of Christ. So you got the words. It's really interesting because the word son, a capital S, and the word law, capital L, and the word word, capital W, like the word of God, the law of God, and the Son of God, those are all the same thing. The Son of God is the parabolic, metaphoric, aphorism, allegory is the word I'm trying to use, to explain the natural law through a personified character, right? If it was Disney, they'd turn it into a skunk, and you'd follow the skunk, and it'd fucking mislead you all over the place, and you'd never actually understand it. But the Bible is actually a very sincere attempt to have you be able to follow this character, do what that character does, and thus be under the natural law. And when we say the natural law, we don't mean, oh, look, there's some pretty trees and some flowers. When we say natural law, we really mean the law of source, or the law of self-existence, the law of self-evidence. In other words, anything that's not man-made. Natural law refers to your origin, your source. And the reason that the and I say this with all, it's very important that people understand, the reason that the Bible is so important is because it's actually part of the aphorism that is the set of maxims that are the law, the principles that are expressed. For instance, the contract makes the law is a maxim of law. If you're under contract, which is what a citizenship is, then the contract makes the law. You're no longer under the natural law. What does the Bible say? Never take contract. It also says never take a person or respect a person. Never take a flattering title. That's doctor, lawyer, anything that's comes from a principle, a source that is not of God, i.e. nature, a reality, right? Don't respect persons. Don't respect flattering titles. Don't respect fabled genealogies, which is the bloodlines. Okay,
Clint, let me just interrupt you for a second to explain to people for a moment about God being a verb and not a noun.
Yeah,
so that,
yeah. So the problem with the English language, and I get the feeling from listening to you, Jan, and the shows you've been doing together with this history thing, and you know, I'm certainly a big fan that of saying history is all bunk.
I haven't even gotten to the topic yet, to be honest. Yeah. We're barely touching on it yet.
Even the history that we tell each other, right? I mean, I'll tell you my life story. I'm going to admit a bunch of shit that I don't want you to know, right? I did this. It was stupid. I'm not going to tell you that, right? We lie to each other on a constant basis. That's what we do. That's what we've been trained to do, right? We go into a job interview. We lie. We lie. We are lying people because that's how we're raised. And, of course, the Bible says, do not lie. Live in truth. Truth will set you free. All these great quotes come directly from the Bible, but nobody ever gives credit to them, right? Wolf in sheep's clothing, all that stuff comes right from the Bible.
And that's, ironically, the logo of the Fabians who were running the show on a lot of this crap.
So you find these concepts. If you take... The truth will set you free. If you capitalize the truth and free, then you're talking about the natural law. Well, you know, reality will set you free. Keep it real, man. But if you're the Fabians, then they're going to say the truth, which is all the lies that we create and then confirm and ratify, right? The truth, the little truth, the little t truth, will set you free. But what they don't tell you is if you look in their dictionary, in their terms of art, which, you know, doctors have their own terms of art. Lawyers have their own terms of art. Scientists have their own terms of art. Botanists speak a language no one can understand because they're speaking the Latin names of plants, right? These are terms of art, artificialness, fiction, technology, nothing real. And so suddenly I find out the word free in the legal language or the higher language that they call it, the king's language, actually means franchise. What they're really saying is that the lies will put you into a franchise. The truth will set you free, but the adversarial, satanic version, the Luciferian version, the false light, is that the truth, which means lies, will set you in a franchise, which is like a citizenship, right? All the slaves weren't freed, they were put into a franchise, and so were we. So, this is the kind of example of how we need to relearn language, because the language that's in the Bible is metaphorical. Everything in the Bible is metaphorical. We don't even need to have a discussion on whether the Bible is a history. The idea of the history is as, or the Bible is as a prophecy. Prophecy is not a fortune teller telling the future. Prophecy simply means if you follow this path, this is what's going to happen.
Exactly. It's like, if you follow this path and don't follow some basic rules, you're going to end up in a shithole down the road.
Right. So you've got, exactly. And that's basically what it tells you. And that's what, you know, you turn your back on the natural law, the foundational law of things, and you respect persons, you respect money and its valuation, which is called mammon. Then this is going to happen to you. You're going to become a debtor to it. You're going to love it and then thus become its slave, essentially, which is all what's happened to us. So the Bible, you notice the Bible has no date. How can you call something a history without any dates? It's a timeless document that each character in the Bible actually is the story of you at some point in your journey, in your path. Right, if I'm Noah,
and when you say the Bible, somebody was asking, are you talking about the Old or New Testament?
All right, so to be clear, the Old Testament is basically the Jewish, if you will, the Jew is not a word that's necessarily in the Bible, but we'll say for practical purposes of the Jewish law. This is why the Jews, quote-unquote, hate Christianity, because Christianity is the new law. New law fulfills the old law. So imagine the old law is the book of Moses, the Ten Commandments, right? Exodus. You have the Ten Commandments, which says, thou shalt not kill. All right? Thou shalt not do this. Thou shalt not steal. Okay. But since you don't have the New Testament in there saying, well, yeah, you shall not kill, but guess what? If you respect a person and a flattering title, which means I'm not Clint, a man, you know, of nature. I'm not self-responsible. I'm Clint Richardson, a surname of the state, property of the state. I take a flattering title called soldier or assassin or whatever it is, knight, right? All of a sudden, now I'm not doing the killing. My person is. So self-responsibility is the new law. The old law says thou shalt not kill. Well, you know, if I take upon the person of another, well, then it's really not me doing the killing. And so the new law comes in and says, hey, yeah, you shall not kill, but you shall not also do all the things that would allow you to kill without taking credit or being responsible for it, right? And so you think
which
of
is taking up, which is taking up the fictitious character.
Right. Think of it as a wall with bricks, and all of a sudden the mortar comes in and just seals those Ten Commandments to the point where they can't be broken. That's why they say the old or the new law fulfills the old law, and that's why the Jews, you know, the new law says no money, man. Charity and love. Oh, be peace, you know. Oh, we can't have that. How are we supposed to have our inequitous money system and have everybody in debt if the love of money is the root of all evil? How am I going to do? What am I going to do? Well, I'm going to deny the new law. I'm going to create all my nations according to the old law. It's problem solved. See, so that's the best answer I have in regards to that is that the New Testament and the Old Testament are pretty much the Old Testament is designed to cheat. The New Testament is designed to take away the ability to cheat. It's the perfection of law, if you will. But in order to understand that, you're going to have to read it every word. You're going to have to decipher every word with its cipher, which is the codexes, the lexicons, the Greek, the Latin, the Chaldean.
Look up every single word in Strong's. Look up the definitions. Look it up in the Latin and then the Hebrew right. And in the Greek, etc.
One of those words that you're going to be really surprised at is the word God. God... it's a generic term. It means absolutely nothing until I qualify it. Which God am I talking about? If I go to any dictionary right now, I look up the word magistrate, it says God, or God, it says magistrate. Magistrate is any president, king, mayor, judge of a court, right? So who is this God of the Bible? Well, the king came along because the king is God. And I have quotes from our founding fathers, so-called, that say we get our rights from God, and the king is God, right? The pope is the vicar of God, the vicar of Christ. The queen is anointed, the vicar of Christ, which means replacement or anti-Christ, anti-God. Pope claims the ability to be infallible and rewrite the Bible, even though the Bible says take no law before this, right? So the word God, it can mean the highest possible form, which is Jehovah, right? And you have to forget everything you've learned. Everything you've learned comes from Alice Bailey and her freaking Theosophical Society and that's influenced David Icke and all these other people. You catch what's his name, Jordan Maxwell, just outright lying about words, what words actually mean. Again, coming from this Theosophical...
George Lucas.
And that Theosophical Society has control of the United Nations, Lucifer Publishing turned into Lucius Trust, you know.
Right.
All that.
LucasArts. Right.
So the word God. The word God can mean Jehovah. And I'll tell you what that means. Because once you learn what that means, the whole damn thing changes. Everything changes when you just define the frickin' word God. That nobody's ever done before. I'd never heard this before, right? It means Elohim, which is gods, a plural for the gods. It means Theos, which is God-like. It means magistrate, king. It means judge of any type of court situation, legal system. Archon is another word that he translated into the word God. And I can go down a whole list of words that all became the word God. So naturally, and I say this to you because this is the most important part, is that the idea is to take us away from the Bible. Everything you hear out there, including the fact that the Bible's out of public schools, you know.
And take us away from natural law, essentially, correct?
Exactly, because you cannot know what natural law truly is without understanding, again, that it's this set of foundational source laws that if you break those, then you're going to be trapped in this legal the legal matrix, the legal system, right? So let's go back to the word Jehovah. Jehovah is not used in Genesis until after everything's all created. It's very interesting when you break down. I break down Genesis as basically the Babylonian creation story, which is it's a name I can never remember. But and you know that because they're still following those gods in the Old Testament. They're following Marduk and Baal. It's all that Baal worship, and that's exactly the story of the Babylonian creation story, right? So it's just a dumbed down version, essentially, of the same story, which is also the Epic of Gilgamesh, and you know this is the same story retold in a new allegory, a new form, to as he was reading earlier, just to satisfy this set of pagans or that set of whatever, right? And that makes sense, you know. We don't have to look at that kind of thing and say, oh, that's it's a copy of a copy. Therefore, I'm not gonna. No, this is the ancient knowledge passed down in story form.
But hidden and contorted too within English and all of these different layers to try to hide it.
But the important part about the Bible is that it has to be, because it's the law, and they acknowledge it as the law, and the only people that can be free are those people who follow that law. They acknowledge that in the court system. That's a whole long, detailed thing, but you know, they recognize the religious man as the same as they recognize a felon or a criminal who's had all their rights taken away from them. That's how they recognize a religious man who's following religiously the law, right? The law. So the most important lesson here is that the Bible is not religion. The Bible is not religion. The Bible is law. It should not be considered as anything having to do with religion, except the fact that it does have some, you know, it does talk about the Babylonian creation gods and all that stuff, trying to get you back to nature, right? Back to reality, the God of nature. So what is God? What is Jehovah? Oh, man. Turns out the word Jehovah is a verb. So it's not the name of a dude. It's not a, you know, of course you personify God so that so that God talks to man. Well, that makes sense. If they're telling a story, you're telling an allegory, you're telling a metaphor. Of course, that's the story. But the true definition, the intention of the word Jehovah is all of existence, or more accurately, all that is in self-existence. So everything that's happening right now that is real, that is of nature, that is not man-made, you could say that's creation if you want. All that is, was, and shall be, the I am, all those different things. The point is that it's everything that's reality. It's all of nature as it's happening right now. That is Jehovah. All right? You don't have to take it any farther. You don't have to put it in any form or thing unless you're telling the story and you want God to talk to man. Well, then God appears in the clouds, right? And that's where everybody, that's where everybody goes astray. It's like, oh, I don't believe that. Really? Because you have taken King Arthur, you've taken Robin Hood, you've taken all the fairy tales and all the different stories you've heard all your life, and you know those are fictional characters, and yet you love them. You watch superhero movies, you think, ah, Superman, The only superhero that you can actually love is freaking Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ, translated, means Jehovah is salvation. Nature, the natural...
And basically, it's just a way to navigate via natural law through the manufactured art or fiction that they've created and put in front of us, essentially.
Respect nothing artificial, nothing man-made, period, end of story. We sit around, we argue over all kinds of things. One of those things is money. What is lawful money? What is real money? What is this? There's no real money. Are you insane? Money is being the root of all evil. See, the maxim of law is again very clear about money, and you can't bypass the maxim, the principle of law. You just can't, because it's what the whole system is foundationally set upon. And the maxim of law says that money, while anything can be valued in money, money is never valued in anything. money or mammon, the word mammon means valuation. So I no longer see nature as a priceless creation of God, all of that, you know, hokey stuff. But it's not hokey after all, because the second that I put a price, the second I put a valuation, especially upon myself, where the maxims of law are clear that no man can be merchandised, no man should put a value upon himself. But the problem is I'm eight bucks an hour. I'm not acting as a man of God. I'm acting as a person of the state, property of the state, not property of nature. So my law is not of nature. My law is of the contract, which makes the law. See, the Bible is very clear. The law, when I say the Bible, I mean the law, the Son, the Word, right, says don't do any of these things that we do on a daily basis. We live our whole lives in fiction. We lie to ourselves at every turn. We believe in everything that is completely artificial. Sorry, I just got attacked by my cat, man. And I've got all these papers everywhere because I'm right at the end of this book. But, yeah, if you go into the Bible and you realize that every time you see the word God, you're going to have to look it up, because you're going to find out that the Elohim created the God, the heavens and the earth, which is just a metaphor for basically. Right.
Well, and I had written about this in ANS. I think it was Genesis, I believe, where it says Elohim. And you look that up, and it's actually the landlords there, and there was like seven of them.
Exactly. The gods.
Right.
Anytime you worship anybody, anytime you follow another's law or act in another's property, which is what personhood is.
And that's contract.
They're your God. They're your lawmaker. It's that simple. That's what God means. It's a very generic term that can be applied to almost anything.
Landlord, boss, chief. President, whatever, these are gods.
Yeah, anything like that. And that's the point. The point is, now, you cannot use the excuse that God is a bully. Because when God is being a bully, it's actually a king, or some other magistrate, some archon, or something that is not Jehovah. Because, I mean, think about it. Think about this really carefully. If I talk to you about existence itself, yeah, we could call it a design. Right, because nature is so it's so perfectly wound together. The laws of nature are so absolutely incredible that we have life, we have the perfect air, we have the perfect water, we have this perfect system that sustains us, right? You could call that a design if you want to, or you can just call it nature, right? And what the hell was I going to say? Then you have all of man's creation. Right, which is, what's the maxim of law? This is so important. Maxim of law in science and in law says that you will never, ever, ever be able to find the source of existence, the source of life. No matter how many crazy fucking things you do, no matter how many life forms you tear apart and kill to find their life, the final thing you can pick. You cannot ever, ever know what causes life. You can reproduce, you can recreate, you can take things out of nature, put them together, give them a name, give them a patent, and say they're your own creation, but they're not. And see, the fact that we respect names, which are nouns, persons, places, or things, the fact that we respect names over the reality they represent, right? If I call a man a slave and I believe that, then I believe the man is truly a slave, even though there's no such thing as a slave. Right? That's the valuation. That's the mammon. So you've got this, again, you've got this kind of like perfect design that is nature that we should be protecting and respecting. We're not supposed to be the overlords of nature. We're supposed to be the protectors. This stuff wasn't given to us so we could play with it like a freaking constructor set and ruin everything. Right, ruin that design, if you will. No, we're supposed to be the watchers. We're supposed to be the guys who stop. But instead, what do? We allow artificial persons. What's an artificial person? A corporation, an association, a municipal corporation is a city, state, or district, or county. We allow corporations, artificial persons, to rule us. The president is an artificial person. The pope is an artificial person. You know, there is no pope. There is no queen. The queen, the crown of the queen and the position and the crown of the pope and the position of pope belongs to the Vatican, belongs to a fucking corporation, an artificial person. So if you're going to worship the pope, you have to worship the corporation from which the pope comes from. If you're going to worship the kingdom, the United Kingdom, you're worshiping an artificial person, right? You're worshiping something not real.
There's an episode you did with Daniel a while back. I didn't actually say this before the show. I've listened to your radio show for quite a long time. Big fan. There was an episode you did with Daniel where you talked about how corporations are given birth certificates. I think it was by Samuel Fox. What you were just talking about reminded me about that.
Yeah, and I have that quote somewhere in 5,000 pages of research.
I have the book.
Did you get the book?
Yeah, where is it?
It was by Chris, C-R-I-S, right?
Yeah, let me see if I can find it here. Yep.
You know, it's nuts. It's nuts when you start, because remember, exactly. Remember that corporations are people too. You know? They have rights. What is a right? A right simply means that I have the ability to do something and you have an obligation to, a forced obligation to do it. That's why all this stuff about gay rights, this rights, and that rights, those aren't equal rights. Those are rights for a specific class, and it forces everybody else under a contractual obligation, you know, according to law. These aren't rights. This is completely different than what's called equitableness or the natural law, which says, I have the right not to be messed with. I have the right not to believe in that shit. I have the right not to accept you as normal because you call yourself a man, woman, she-male, right? I have the right not to respect that flattering title. That's the whole point of the natural law. And unfortunately, that means we have choice. That means that everything we're doing is voluntary. Everybody's going, I want to be in a voluntary society. Trust me when I say it. I prove this time and time and again. We are in a voluntary society. The only reason we're not, you know, under military wrath all the time is because we volunteer in commerce. Right? As soon as commerce gets blocked up, then war happens. Then we go back to commerce, free-flowing commerce. That's called peace. Right? So we're in a voluntary society. And the word volunteerism, simply translated into the English language, volunteerism is a word that is used for the doctrine of master and servant. That's what volunteerism is. It means you're volunteering to be under some god. That's all it means. You have that.
So in other words, when you work for some corporation or a company or whatever, you're consenting to be there.
You're a franchisee.
You're an employee. It's actually right. Once you learn the law of agency, everything changes. Law of agency is the same thing as trustee and truster, employer, employee, lawyer, and client. You become an agent, and you get the agentic sort of. Are you familiar with the Mill? Oh, what's his name? The studies he did on the agency where the shock.
Stanley or Milgram.
Milgram.
I mean, I'll read just a couple things from Milgram that'll explain exactly what his study revealed. In 1974 in Harper's Magazine, Pearls of Obedience, he stated, the legal and philosophic aspects of obedience are of enormous importance, but they say very little about how most people behave in concrete situations. I set up a simple experiment at Yale University to test how much pain an ordinary citizen as an agent, would inflict on another person simply because he was ordered to do so by an experimental scientist. Stark authority was pitted against the subject's or participant's strongest moral imperatives, against hurting others, and with their ears ringing from the screams of the victims, authority won more often than not. The extreme willingness of adults to go to almost any length on the command of an authority constitutes the chief finding of the study and the fact that most urgently demanding explanation. Ordinary people simply doing their jobs, and without any particular hostility on their part, can become agents in a terribly destructive process. Relatively few people have the resources needed to resist authority. What are the resources needed to resist authority? Well, I'm here to tell you, after 3 years of just kind of checking out and doing the study, the Bible is truly the only resource that you need to resist authority. Why do I say that? Because authority, in their law, says the Bible is the highest law.
That reminds me of Horace Greeley.
Yeah.
Hey, I wanted to ask you, Clint, and we were talking about this yesterday or day before, but you had a short argument for debunking atheism. Why don't you hit that one?
Oh, yeah. Well, so now that you know... Now that you know the definition of Jehovah, right, which is a verb, and it means all of existence, self-existence, all that is oneness, that's what monotheism really means, is that you're not worshiping the sea and the mountains and the sky as different gods. You're worshiping all of nature, all of the universe, if you will, as one, if you will, life form, if you will, God, right? It's a really beautiful sentiment, and it permeates every other religion out there. It's not strictly a Christianity kind of thing. And by the way, Christianity is not in the Bible. It's there, but it's an insult. You're not supposed to be a Christian. It doesn't say that. It says follow Christ. It says don't become a frickin' Methodist or Catholic. Catholic's not in the frickin' Bible. Right? So you're supposed to follow Christ, which is the Son, the Law, and the Word of God. Same thing. Follow the law. Follow the law. That's all you got to do.
Follow the right-hand path, essentially. Follow keeping consistent with nature.
Right. Again, not reality. Just right. Law. So atheism is the simplest thing to defeat. And I want you to think about all the different debates that you've ever seen. And I used to love to watch these. You had the atheists versus the intelligent designers versus the evolutionists, right?
There's that Spencer Tracy movie back in the day. What was that one called?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. what's this called? Ay. So you watch these guys, and, you know, Hitchcock was one of them, the guy who wrote the God Delusion. And then you had on the other side freaking Kirk Cameron and people like that, right? And they're always beating the hell out of the religion.
Crocodile or whatever the hell it was.
Right, because the religious people don't know the Bible, or if they do know the Bible, they're reading it in English. For God's sake, you can't read the Bible in English. Ask anybody that knows Greek; they'll say you cannot translate our beautiful language, our beautifully poetic, romantic language, into that shit language called which the Black's Law calls dog Latin. That's what English is, right? It's the worst of the worst. It's truly, we're a bunch of illiterates. It's called the language of illiteracy, literally. A mongrel language is what Twain called it. And truly, we're very fooled by our knowledge of the English language, specifically because it's a literal language, and all the other old languages are metaphorically, poetically versed, right? And that's why they say the gods speak, the gods of the nations specifically, and the Bible says the gods of the nations are idols, right? So it's using that word God that tells you that it's not talking about Jehovah, right? It's not talking about nature. So atheism is defined as, now everybody's going to say, oh, well, that's not what I mean. When I say I'm an anarchist, I mean this. Well,
next all
what is it specifically defined as? What is the intent?
It's your pork fest.
It means, if you look it up, it's always pretty much the same concept. It's the non-belief in the existence of God. The non-belief in the existence of God. But we just define Jehovah. What do we define Jehovah as? All of self-existence. All that is creation. All that is not man-made. Everything that's of nature, of the universe. As one whole thing or being. Being being a verb, right? It's in being.
It's
right?
one action, one
it's
motion.
Now it's right. You have to rethink from the noun to the verb or to the adjective. You have to think outside of the time domain. You say it's happening now, and it will forever happen, and it forever has happened. That's so. It's existence, right? So how do you defeat atheism? Well, atheism is simply a misunderstanding of what the word God means or the word Jehovah means, because then when you redefine atheism and you put the right word in for God, which is Jehovah, which is existence, atheism is the non-belief in the existence of existence. And when I figured that one out, I'm like, oh, that's beautiful. Because you look at these debates, and I want to remind people that these debates are designed to take you away from the Bible. They're made to make the Bible look ridiculous. And what that does is make you ridiculous, because you'll never learn the law. You'll consider the Bible as you consider these religions that have nothing to do with the Bible. The Bible, last thing it says is, hey, take no other doctrines before this. But see, go define the word doctrine, it means law. Don't take any other law but this, but the natural law, the law of God, as they call it.
Right. The right-hand path, essentially, keeping consistent with reality, not following fiction, not going down the path of mysticism, which is the tool of tyrants and yada, yada, yada. I mean, it all connects together.
What is the atheist, then? The atheist is exactly what he was reading from in the beginning.
Should we have Jacob just read it?
Yeah, because it literally is the personification of nihilism. That's what it is. What is nihilism? The non-belief in existence, right? Nothing exists. Remember Mark Stevens? No, that doesn't exist. We have no foundation. Nothing exists. No, there's no belief in existence. It's just nihilism. And
threat, duress, coercion, repeat.
Lacan's Simulation is a great book to read about that, because he compares the nihilistic or the atheist of yesterday, which is the French Revolution, which actually had meaning, to the nihilism and the atheism of today, which has no point, has no purpose. It's not trying to prove or get anything. These people are just walking around.
Matt is asking. Matt is asking who created the word atheist. Was it Thomas Huxley? You know, I'm not sure. I have looked that up before, but I don't recall it. Very possibly.
All I know is that in those disputed quotes by Albert Pike, he talks about turning the nihilists, the atheists, and the nihilists against the Christians, and letting, just like the Arabs and the Jews that they created in Israel are going to go at each other, and wipe themselves out, so too will the nihilists and the Christians just go at each other like we're already trained to do. And they're just letting ourselves wipe each other out, basically.
This reminds me of some reading I've been doing recently. Before we go further, it was about Scaliger and Petavius, and it was about quadrature theory, and his whole idea that you could create, and I'm taking this off the top of my head off a very light reading on the subject, so if I get it completely wrong, I apologize, where you tried to make the area of polygons greater than the area of a circle. So you take polygons about the same size as a circle, and you'd have more area within the polygons than the circle itself. And people kept going to Scaliger telling him, it's impossible. Geometry continually proves you false. You can't do this. You're not going to get this right. And Scaliger's, who is responsible for chronology. And everyone would prove him wrong by just circumscribing a circle around it and showing that the area is greater in the circle than in the polygon. And then he would just violently refuse them, to the point where he called them crazy. He put every fallacy on the book to put every detractor against him to the ground. It was insane. So it reminds me of your argument you just showed between atheists and creationists.
Yeah, it's a purely it's purely fallacious. A lot of our arguments in society are based on fiction, right? We're deciding which is the better version of the lie, which is truth. And we have this truth movement. And I don't know about you, Jan, but man, as soon as I started actually finding out the truth, Which is to say that sovereign.
There is no movement of truth. It's not a bowel movement. You know, you go, you get to truth point by point. You don't crap it out. You know.
Well, I found out that nobody actually wants to interview you if you're actually saying, "Well, this is all bullshit." First, the corporation, the state, the people is a corporation. It's not a real people, right? There's the state holds sovereignty. The state holds a lodial title. No man does. You're always beholden to some artificial freaking person or some corporation, and so there's no sovereignty. That's the foundation of the. Of the sovereign movement, the liberty movement, the truth movement, the patriot movement, right? And it's non-existent. It's all based on fallacious thoughts. And I'm here.
And they're all controlled opposition as well. They're created and manufactured and put there. That's why they call it Pork Fest. Pork. They're feeding the pigs. Pork Fest. Panage. Pork Fest. Panage. Get panage. It into your head. Panage.
Passio. Panage. Pork food.
Yeah, Passio is a panage for swine to feed on mast in the woods, and then you go to the Pork Fest. I mean, come on, folks.
Right. So, yeah, it's the beautiful thing is that you start looking at the foundations. When the foundation falls, the superstructure thus must fall. And I'm here to say, for all the things that I used to believe, and it's not so much that I was wrong or that anybody else was wrong or that the guys that are dying today that have been in the Patriot movement since the 60s up there in, you know, where it started up in Montana, Michigan, you know, there's all kinds of books out there on this shit. But what people are confusing is the way they want things to be, the natural law and the way things should be with the way things are. And as soon as you look at the, you say, okay, who cares what I think? I want to know how things really work. And as soon as you start looking at it for that in reality, in the truth of the truth, right? Because truth, you can't have sides of the truth. There's only one truth to anything, right?
Absolutely. And a contradiction is always a lie or an error. And you always know if you're consistent with reality, if you're following natural law, that you only need to dig further down into the information until the contradictions disappear.
And that's the beautiful thing about the Bible, is basically what it tells you is, hey, that's your litmus test right there. Is it real or is it Memorex? Is it a creation of God, nature, whatever, or is it a creation of man? As soon as you decipher that something's a creation or thought or concept of man, and that, you know, that includes geometry, that includes all these things. Geometry is form without substance, right? You don't worship these things. You don't call them sacred, because if you call something that is artificial as sacred, that word gets magically transformed into the word curse. So if I sacredly worship something that is not of nature, I'm cursing you. I'm literally cursed because I believe in something that is not real. Yes, it's man's way of representing things in nature that he could not possibly do. I get that. I'm not disrespecting it. Although I criticize the number system, you know, 1 through 10 it's perfect. You can't really make a mistake, so it's not really that impressive to me. Like I can do all these mathematical equations, but I know the answer's there. It's a perfect system. It can't be wrong because it's just 1 through 10. I mean, it's like a language that's made to be perfect, right? So you can't really go wrong with it. You can make human mistakes, but you know, nobody ever criticizes these languages, right? That are same thing with worded languages. Same thing with computer algorithms. What is the matrix? Matrix is a bunch of freaking numbers and letters and codes going down a screen. That's all it is.
Yeah, Outram. Steve Outram says Zionism published in books in 1860s before the Pike Letter.
And just wanted.
He says, Zionism published in books in 1860s before Pike Letter. In 1862, Moses Hess, former associate of Karl Marx and Frederick Engels, wrote Rome and Jerusalem. And then from Wikipedia. Anyway, that's Steve Outram, his regular guest of the show and large contributor here. You know what? I want to... Yeah, let's let Jacob read that quote there. It's a doozy. So, Jacob, you ready? Get a drink of water down before you do that?
I just wanted to pour a little bit of water to wet the whistle a little bit. Where do you want me to start? Do you want me to just start?
Just try to read the whole thing and plow through it.
I don't know how. It's long, so
yeah. Just hit it. Let's know.
Yeah. If it gets to a point, just stop me. Okay. Just
all right.
Stop.
All right. Let's go.
All right. The Shylock of Shakespeare. This is a lecture prepared by Professor Sir Israel Gallant. It's called The Shylock of Shakespeare. Lecture delivered before the Jewish Historical Society at University College, Gower Street, WC. I guess that's West Cambridge, maybe, perhaps. I could be wrong about that. Monday, 22nd of May, 1916. Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, I am not this evening going to put before you all those different variations of the Shylock story that are to be found in all the different nations east and west. A whole volume might easily be made up of the variations of the theme familiar to us. We will take that as understood by all of you, and in almost every country of Europe, these stories are to be found. I am not even going to point out the varyings of the Shylock story, in which the villain of the piece, the Shylock, is not the Jew, but the non-Jew. All that we will take as readily known to everyone in the room. No edition of Shakespeare's play is without an introduction setting forth the stories that Shakespeare used, or is supposed to have used, or setting forth all the knowledge that the editor happens to possess of parallels to the Shylock story.
Let me just comment here. Shylock, if I'm not mistaken, is from The Merchant of Venice?
I believe so. He mentions The Merchant of Venice later on in this lecture.
So that's one of the books. All this non-bias shit that's coming in schools and everything is coming from the ADL. And Shylock, The Merchant of Venice, is one of the books that they wish to ban from schools because it portrays Jews in a bad light. Just wanted to throw that out there.
Interesting. Thank you for adding that. There's actually a third lecture at the end of this book about The Merchant of Venice. So once I get to that, I'll be happy to share all the information. Okay, so let's see. I am not going to deal with the play or the character from that point of view. What I am going to try to do is this. I'm going to take, as it were, an entirely fresh perspective of the play and its relation to literature and to drama. I am not going to hold any brief for Shakespeare's humanity or for his attempt to satisfy the prejudices of his age. I am simply going to put the character of the whole play in a position that I think may quicken apprehension of what is at the back of the play and help to an understanding of what belongs to the theme as its inherent intrinsic part of the plot that Shakespeare took over, whatever he may have made of it. Now, what I am becoming more and more impressed with as I attempt to understand Shakespeare is this, that Shakespeare, as is the case with many of the very greatest artists, whether they be poets, or whether they be dramatists, or whether they belong to the plastic arts or the art of painting, that Shakespeare, in dealing with each of his stories, the tale or the novel or whatever else might have come to his hand, had the instinctive power of divining, unconsciously perchance, but divining, the germ of the particular myth behind it. I mean this. If you take such a play as King Lear, you have a story there of an ancient king of Britain who, in his old age, became very foolish in his attitude towards his children, and who suffers tribulation for the two daughters who are cruel and heartless, and who finds the comfort that he had originally rejected from the gentle daughter Cordelia. We know the play. We know how difficult it is to put on the stage. We know how any representation of it is a vain attempt to do justice to the drama. You turn to your critics, and your critics tell you this or that you should be the characteristic of the actor performing Lear or the daughters. And then comes a great critic, such as Charles Lamb, who, going to the play and seeing some of the greatest performers perform Lear, boldly writes that, quote, "The Lear of Shakespeare cannot be acted," end quote. And yet, Shakespeare wrote his play for acting, and Charles Lamb was no mean critic. And Shakespeare was no mean dramatist. Then, in course of time, comes a student of early British history, and he makes an interesting discovery. He discovers that it is true. In British history, you come across the story of King Lear. You know the date when he reigned. You know everything about him. Is he not in history books? Then comes your student of folklore and anthropology, and makes it clear that the history we have of King Lear in history books represents the rationalization of an ancient myth, where King Lear is Neptune, the Scandinavian and Celtic Neptune, and the rough, heartless daughters are the fierce waves, that gentle Cordelia is the mild wave. Shakespeare knows nothing concerning what is at the back of this myth, which figures in British history, which dramatists before him had found a delightful theme for entrancing Elizabethan audiences. He knows nothing of that, but his genius unconsciously divines the myth, and so the Lear of Shakespeare becomes something too great for any stage. I shall not trouble you with history, though you are the Jewish Historical Society. If you look at this play of The Merchant of Venice carefully, you will have to consider at what point it comes into the whole range of drama, that Elizabethan drama which, during its first 30 years, from about 1558 to 1588, had all the elements, commingling elements, linking that Elizabethan age far back to the very beginning of the Christian church, on the one hand, and, on the other, ranging far back to a period long before the beginning of Christianity, to the ancient drama of Greece and Rome. All these elements are commingled in that period of formation of the Elizabethan drama from 1558 to 1588. And in the long procession that one sees, a long, drawn-out procession heralding Shakespeare, one may, in fact, in that rapid-moving procession, see one or two important items to which, very briefly, I desire to draw your attention. You know that even in the Elizabethan age, we still had the old drama existing, going back to the time when the Christian church, by creating a liturgical drama, tried to win the newly converted pagans from the attractions of the gladiatorial shows. The church found that the best way to do that was to dramatize first the offices of the church, and, secondly, Bible stories. And in our procession of the new drama, the drama of the modern world, that dramatizing of the scriptural stories takes a very important place. The church learnt very early that in order to teach the people, an illiterate people, the best way was to appeal to them through the pagan, or, I'm sorry, let me start that over again. The church learned very early that in order to teach the people, an illiterate people, the best way was to appeal to them through the pageants of the liturgical drama and the whole history of the Bible from creation to the crack of doom. All sorts of elements were introduced and were very early dramatized. But very early, I should think probably between the 8th and 10th centuries of the Christian era, there was discovered a very obvious thing, namely, that not only was it desirable to teach the people the biblical story by dramatizing that story, but that you might appeal to the congregation by dramatizing a scriptural text, practically the sermon dramatized. And that brings us to the second stage in the history of our modern drama, this early medieval drama, the dramatization of the scriptural text. Already, about the 12th century, we have such a theme as, quote, righteousness and peace have kissed one another, end quote. It took some three centuries before this kind of drama, the moral drama in which the characters were allegorical and set forth for the education and betterment of human life, became a popular form of drama in England. We have it by the 15th century. This was a drama of allegory, and were my theme allegory, I could very well give the minutes at my disposal to dealing with the subject alone. Its importance is not well recognized. Allegory was made an important point of interpretation of biblical texts by the early church fathers. But allegory became predominant in English literature from the 14th to the 15th century. And anyway, in Shakespeare's early youth, he not only beheld from the pageants, such as he saw in Coventry, the story of Noah, the story of Jacob, of Abraham and Isaac, but he also saw sermons, moral plays put before him, and we know of one contemporary, a young boy of Gloucester, born in the same year, who left us an account, some years after Shakespeare's death, how, as a child, standing between his father's knees, he beheld one of these moral plays, the cradle of security, and how the influence of this play, in which all the characters were allegorical, remained an abiding possession throughout his whole life. Now, if there is one subject that interested the early churchmen in preaching their sermons, it was, of course, the great story, the essential part of the Christian creed. Let us approach it as students and see what would happen supposing a preacher of the 11th or 12th century were to put effectively and dramatically before a crude and rude audience such a text as the following, quote, "Greater love hath no man than this, that a man should lay down his life for his friend," end quote. Or such a text as this, quote, "Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it," end quote. No text was more often used by the preachers. And if you attempt to put before an unlettered audience either of these texts, or both of them, you will have a moral drama enforcing the lessons that the preacher wished to enforce. How else is it to be done save by showing in contrast the tenderness and self-sacrifice of Christ on the one hand, and the alleged heartlessness, the alleged brutality, according to the popular tradition, hatred, and bias of the Jew on the other hand? And if, when you have put these two characters in juxtaposition for the purpose of enforcing the text, you'll wish to graft on that one text, the second text that I have quoted, "Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it," how else is your church to be personified, save as a spouse desired and longed for? So that your second text must needs provide not only the lady typifying salvation, tenderness, the fairest attribute of the Almighty, not only that, but also a sequence of suitors who, in order to win her, make their various efforts, and for whom, as regards the one particular suitor who is to succeed, the self-sacrificing character is ready to give his very lifeblood, his very heart, to the cruel adversary typifying the attribute of cruelty associated in the popular mind with our own people. Now, you will say that I cannot point to chapter or verse for such an explanation at the back of the Shylock story. But read your medieval literature, such a book, for example, as The Nun's Rule, which belongs to about the early 13th century, one of the most beautiful books in English literature, written by a man who understood human nature, and especially the nature of the nuns he wrote for. In that book, we have these texts, both these texts, chosen and allegorized in a very fine way so that the lady, the spouse, the church, becomes a noble lady who is besieged in her castle by many an adversary until the last, the right wooer, the son of a neighboring king, is victorious. And in that book, which belonged to the 13th century, we come across the following reference. "Do not men account him a good friend who layeth his pledge in jewelry to release his companion? God Almighty laid himself in jewelry for us." I therefore say that the starting point of the legend of Shylock, I would insist on emphasizing it as a legend, the legend going back to the time of prejudice and hatred, which can still be understood, that legend had been created, I feel sure, by some early monkish divine in a dramatic homily, and from the dramatic homily, all the permutations and combinations have developed. And I will say this, that when, in the textbooks and studies which we constantly have of The Merchant of Venice, we are told that the story of Shylock comes from one particular source. And the story, I'm sorry, I just lost the place there, comes from one particular
source. Is that a good place to interrupt maybe? How much more you got there?
I could just finish up this paragraph right here.
Sure.
First of all, let's see, The Merchant of Venice, we are told that the story of Shylock comes from one particular source and the story of the Fair Lady of Belmont from another source. All that is, to my mind, quite fictitious. There may be different variants with reference to the two component parts of the story, but they represent the component parts of one of the same story, arising out of the blending of the two texts I have quoted to you. And then he moves on to the 16th century after that, talking about more plays. And then it kind of moves up to Shakespeare.
All right. Here, let me just interject something here before you answer or go to that, Clint. And somebody just said, Clint uses the New Testament as some type of natural law handbook, but I thought that it's just a fabrication by Rome to suppress the Messianic uprising.
Okay. Well, you're welcome to your thought. I'm searching. When I read the Bible, here's what I, there's two things that I do. One, I say everything that every man out there in Radio Land has ever said about the Bible is bullshit. I'm not going to listen to it. I'm going to read the Bible for what it says. I'm going to look at the intent of the author, or at least the intent of the word that was used in the old languages. I'm not going to listen to anybody's opinion. I don't even know if Rome was real, right? We don't know anything about these kind of histories that you talk about. The second thing I look for is what is called self-evident truth or self-existent truth. Those are the only truths that actually exist. If I look at a tree, it's self-evident. I don't need to put a name on it. I don't need to give it a history. I don't need to know who its mommy was. It's self-evident. It's existence. I don't need to question it. I don't need to name it unless I want to make it my property. Then I put a name on it, and I do all kinds of evil things to it, right? So when I'm reading the Bible, what I'm looking for is self-evident truth. And that's what the Bible tells me to do. And guess what? That's what you find. Now, I say in my book, I say, look, the Bible's got a curse on it. Or rather, mankind has a curse on it, which is to say that if you go and you read the Bible and you're looking for some evil shit, you're going to find it. Because how do you explain good without explaining evil at the same time? How do you know anything unless you know its fucking opposite? You don't, right? So when you're reading the Bible, you're looking for wisdom. If you're reading it to prove some scholar's theories or some Jewish theory or some Christian theory, that's what you're going to get. But if you're reading it simply searching for the law of source, the law of foundation, law of reality, that is what you will find. Because that's what's written inside. And that's the litmus test. Look for what is reality, what cannot be denied. It's not because the Bible says it. It's because the Bible is talking about something that's already exists. This is ancient knowledge. Bible is not the original. It's actually a simulacrum, which is a copy without an original. There's no original Bible. Right? I'm not going to sit here and tell you that this is the only end-all, be-all book. I'm telling you this is a collection of ancient knowledge that has been suppressed from all of us, including you and including me, that has put us into this legal system. And I'll tell you one more thing. I would never have been able to understand what the Bible is trying to tell me, except that I spent wasted my frickin' life learning the legal language. Which is what I started writing the book about. The legal language and how it's completely metaphoric. It's completely opposite to every word that you use. If I say for, it means against. If I say, you know, there's not even a definition in legalism for love. They say it's an inducement to contract. In other words, inducement to marriage. When I'm reading the Bible, I'm simply looking for the self-evident truth. I know it when I read it. I don't need the Bible specifically to tell me that that's what I'm seeing or hearing. It's self-evident, right? God is defined as all that is self-evident and self-existent. Not a thing, not a person, not a place. If you look, again, if you look at it, if you read the Bible with eyes that want to see, ears that want to hear, then that's what you're going to get. But if you approach it with all these preconceived notions and all the different tricks that have been used to steer you away from the Bible, then that's what you're going to get. Because you're not going to do the study. You're going to read something and say, oh, yeah, I'm familiar with the English language. That's exactly what they told me. Instead of going, well, what does that mean in the Greek? And how does that compare? Is it out of context? Did the king change the word to suit the king? Did, you know, what actually... I'm telling you, unless you do due diligence and unless you at the same time compare the legal language or the legal man to the spiritual man or the spiritual law, so the legal man and the Christ man, and they're walking together and you can see their paths laid out together, that's the only way you're going to understand this thing. And that's what I tried to do with this book, is to lay out the two paths. We're on the legal path. We're all on the wrong path. Well, no matter what we believe, no matter what we think in our heads, we're all acting legally. Every one of you has a driver's license, has property, has title, has all these things the Bible says not to do. And because of that, you're stuck in the money system. And I don't know what to tell you. That's self-evident.
That reminds me of the passage I was just reading, where he talks about how, and he doesn't call out the church by name specifically, but he does capitalize them. When he says that they first dramatize the offices of the church first, which would be their law. So it's the law of the church, not the law of nature. And then after they get the law of the church set up for everybody and they get all their stories and drama set up, then they give them the Bible. And then from that they proceed to
People in the chat room are missing the whole point here. You know, it's like, well, you got to be specific on NIV or King James or what. What he's saying is use the goddamn Strong's Concordance and look up the original definition of every single word in there and trace it all the way out into the ancient Greek, get a Strong's Concordance, and follow it along. It doesn't matter which modern English Bible you're using.
Well, it does matter in the fact that the King James Bible is literally the copyright.
Well, it's numbered for Strong, so it makes it easy, too.
Well, it's the patented law of England. It's therefore the common law, and if the common law of England was transferred over to America. So technically, the King James Bible is the one you want to read, the 1611. But people are
totally missing the whole point in there. They're all over the damn place.
Whatever Bible that you read is going to be built on there could be 20 different words used in 20 different Bibles, but when you look at the concordance, it all goes back to the same word.
Right.
What was the word? Theos. Well, that's not Jehovah. Or whatever the word is. That's all you need to know. You don't need to know what some asshole translated it as just to deceive you, or some church translated it as. No, remember, we're not talking about religion. Religions create Bibles. Religions do all these things. We want to know what the law is. And what I'm trying to tell you, and I know it's very difficult because you have to start thinking differently. You really do have to. It's called spiritual thought, if you will. You have to lose some of your earthly, you know, connections, and you have to start thinking there is a sense that we all share that we know what's right and wrong. We could be psychopathic. We still know what's right and wrong. We still have this sense of law within us, and that's the thing that you start looking for. Now,
natural law, right-hand path. You know that when you tell a lie intentionally to harm or fool somebody or whatever, it's manipulating others, and it's not right, you know.
Right, and the notion of karma carries over into all the legal realm where, you know, the maximum of law, for instance, says to be bound by the law and to know the law are the same things. They don't care if you know the law. They don't care if you're illiterate and sign your name with an X, as long as you agree to be bound by that law. So we're all living in what's called voluntary ignorance, because how many people, raise your hands out there, how many people can recite the entire fucking U.S. code to me? That's what you're under.
Nobody can.
Right? That's what you're under. You're so smart, but yeah, you can't tell me what is Title IV of the U.S. Code. Can you tell me? You can't even tell me the freaking title, let alone what the damn law says.
I've read Title 18, Section 242.
right? So you're under this law. You're bound by this law, even though you don't know it. And that's okay, because you've broken the foundational law. And you've taken another doctrine before it. It's that simple, man. It's not hard. Let me just say one last thing, just so people are clear here. In no way am I apologetic or defending. My book is what I call an equal opportunity offender. I'm offending anybody out there. I'm not offending. I'm just telling you the truth. But it sounds offensive until you realize, oh, yeah, it's just the truth, right? It's just.
Well, if you look at God as a verb and all of this is natural law, then you can lose and shed your preconceived notions about religion and what, you know, Clint's talking about the Bible, and they got to have that reaction about that.
Oh, you got to see, you're just trained to be contrary when it comes to the Bible. You don't even know where it's coming from. I was the same way. This is my way of sort of making amends or reparations, because I used to be the same way. I'm like, I don't even read that damn Bible. That's ridiculous. Oh, man, it's the most enlightening thing you will ever do in your life. And this is why I say I attack everybody. I don't attack everybody. I want to be clear. I tell the truth about everybody in this book. The truth can't harm you, right? If you call yourself a Christian and you're attending a corporation that calls itself a church, you're in no way following Christ. You're using money. You're doing everything against the law, which is the Son, which is the Word of God. You're doing everything against the law by attending a church. If you're a citizen of any state or nation, you're breaking the law of God. If you have a flattering title, if you went to school to get an education, to get a title, so that you could do some employment, an agency to some principal, you're breaking the fucking law. This is what I'm trying to tell you. Am I worried that God's going to smite me down because I'm saying the word F-U-C-K? No, not at all. That's not what the Bible says. Swearing is something completely different. You know, what's amazing to me, Jan, is that it used to actually be against the law. And this is what people don't know. You'll read the dictionaries. They'll tell you. It used to be against the law to do what we do today, which is to talk all this shit about the Bible and blaspheme all the, you know. It actually used to be against the law. It was the common law of Pennsylvania and several other places that if you said the slightest bad thing about the Bible, that you were a criminal, man. You were considered completely, actually dumb. Like you were an idiot. Now, you know, used to be judged by, could you go into a room and have a discussion about politics and religion and law and, you know, the important things. Now you go, you better know the name of the vodka you want. That's about the limits of all you got to do.
Or the latest pop musician or whatever. You know what? But you didn't even get a chance to address what Jacob had read, did you? We got off on
that's what we started with. Is, you know, he started talking about the freaking allegory and everything, and that's
what. Hold on, let Jacob jump in real quick, and then you take off again.
It's still topical to what I was talking about, and we're getting into what you just talked about. There's an image that I sent it to Jan in his email earlier today. It's called the 70 Interpreters in the Ostrog Bible. I wonder if you maybe could pull that up and show it to the viewers, Jan, by any chance.
Which one?
The Ostrog Bible, it's called the 70 Interpreters. It should be in my email, otherwise I can just go and search.
Oh, wait. Oh. Yeah, let's see where this...
It'll be the one I just sent you before we went on a Skype.
My email wasn't open. I rebooted the system before the show.
It's very illuminative because it'll give people an imagery.
Yeah. Of
what we're talking about.
I don't know what I did with that, dude, so, you know, sorry.
Let me just pull up real quick, and I can just share my screen. Let's see here. I think I have my email open.
Well, the thing I was trying to say, just for those that are, you know, you're automatically going to be contrary to what I'm saying because that's how you've been entrained. You'll never want to admit that. But that's the culture. That's everything in culture is to steal you away from the Bible. And you know what? The English language is also designed to steal you away from the Bible. You can't read it in English. That's what I'm trying to tell you, is that English language is the language of illiteracy. If you're a professor in a study of the English language, well, congratulations. You're now a king of upper butt crack. You've done nothing but learn a language designed to keep you down in this literalist sort of functionality where you know, we're all poetry the same way. We're taught now that poetry is for fags, right? I'm not gonna recite poetry to you. That's not romantic. I'm not gonna do anything like that.
And that was yet, my senior thesis.
Poetry is the language of the gods because it's metaphorical. The reason Christ spoke in parables, which pisses everybody off, but you see, if you spoke in parables, then you'd never actually be addressing anyone specifically. You could never get in trouble. You could never slander anybody. So if you ask me a direct question and I answer you indirectly, I'm actually doing the right thing. I'm telling you, well, if you follow this path, you're a dumbass, and if you follow this path, you're smart. Right? But otherwise, I would say, well, Jacob, I think you should do this. Oh, you just gave me legal advice, and I got harmed. I'm going to sue you. See, Jesus was smart enough to never speak directly to anybody except amongst his apostles, his friends, right? Who he knew weren't misogynistic and what's the word for sue happy?
Litigious.
Litigious, right? So he would always give,
like, our litigious friends we wrote about before.
In the parable, and the parable is a timeless, you know, thing that says the path A or path B. This is what'll happen here, and this is what'll happen there. It's your choice, right? So what I'm trying to say is, look, if I wanted to, this book is free. You can download it in PDF. I don't, you know, you don't owe me anything. I just want, see, it doesn't mean no good to have this knowledge without everybody else having it. I can't live alone on this path without other people. And I don't expect everybody to come over and see the light, whatever, but I do expect some people to say, holy shit, and realize that this is the only way out of this system and that we have to get together, be that remainder or that remnant that the Bible talks about that's outside of the legal system, the matrix, whatever you want to call it, right? This is not authorized by church and state. This is a private work. It's not published. It has no barcodes. It has nothing on it. It is my work. No one else. I didn't use my surname. I didn't use any legal entity whatsoever, and that's all explained in it. And trust me when I say this book makes me the public enemy number one of all churches, all religions, especially the Catholic one, because I beat the shit out of the Catholic Church. Right? But the whole time I'm defending the Bible. Because the church has utterly destroyed our ability to read and use the Bible because we're stuck in religion. And the Bible is law. And if I can get that one point across, that the Bible is not religion, and that you're confusing the Bible with whatever religion you hate. And religion is just an artificial person. It's a corporation. The Bible is natural law, I'm telling you.
You want to act religiously, yeah. Act religiously with diligence. You want to study. You want to be honorable. You don't. You know, that's the way life is supposed to be. You know, you don't want to be in a religion. You want to be religious.
I'll give you an example, and this is a bad example, but it's an example. I drink coffee religiously every morning.
I just told a friend that today.
Does that mean coffee is my God? It's my religion? No, it just means I'm doing something in a cultural or habitual way, right? And you got to learn which things you should be doing and which things you shouldn't. And unfortunately, I don't have a freezer full of green coffee and freaking raw milk like some people. I don't roast my
Hey, man, you know, green coffee's cheaper than the crap that you buy roasted in the store for 15, 14 bucks a pound, and it makes you sick and vomit. At least it makes me sick and vomit, you know.
Should have a coffee roast.
I got to roast my own, or I just puke my guts out from that stuff.
That's why I look forward to, you know, my ultimate goal is to get a bunch of people together into some sort of monastery, religious society, whatever you want to call it, situation. Where
monastery,
we're
natural law society.
Yeah, like-minded, and it's the only thing that the Bible recognizes as a sanctuary from law is a monastery. It's why criminals used to run to churches, because they used to be sanctuaries, because they used to be actual churches. Now they're corporations, and they're
God, this person doesn't even get it. He's like, Jan, what happened between now you original podcast with Gino Denny where you talk about Bible books coming from people at trees? They didn't get it at all. He thinks that you're actually frickin' saying that the Bible was written by God, dude. I mean, it's like, you know, he missed the whole frickin' point about it being law and about it being a parable about a character getting through the fictional crap. I mean, how many times do we have to repeat this? I mean, it's like, see one, maybe two people in the chat room there have grasped what you said here.
So another thing I like to say is, and this really helped me to, you know, we were talking about this the other day. That's what the church teaches, that whole thing that he's talking about, right? The question you got to ask yourself is who benefits, right? When we looked at the 9/11 equation, we said, did Osama bin Laden benefit from 9/11 in any fucking way at all? Let's see, he was manhunted. His whole Taliban was hunted. Everything about it was destroyed. Did no money, nothing. Did he? You know, he denied it, right? Did he have any benefit whatsoever from 9/11? No. But who did have the benefit? Why? The government. And the church, and Larry Silverstein, and these people who got rich from that day, the people who traded the stock market, etc., shorted the stock market, right? So you look at who benefits. Well, here's my strongest argument that I can give you as far as the argument. By the way, the scriptural or the natural law is referred to in law as the unwritten law. Okay, so if you consider what that means, it just means it's negative instead of positive. It's not put forward by man. It's, again, the natural law. It's self-evident. It needs not words to...
A tree is a tree.
That kind of thing. Yeah, laws of nature, law of nature. So who benefits? So let's consider the Christ story. The biggest argument you're going to find out there, did Christ exist? Did Christ exist as a historical figure in the Roman timeline? Well, no. After I've read the Bible and I understand everything that it's trying to say, the allegory, the personification, the anthropomorphism, I understand it's not trying to tell me, give me a history of a man. It's not trying to make me worship a man as if that man was God, right? That would be making Christ into a superhero, and super means above. So supernatural means above nature, means something you can't obtain. That's Superman, that's Batman, that's Wonder Woman, depending on your, you know, which way you go, you want to be one of those freaking superheroes. Well, it turns out Jesus Christ, as portrayed as the allegorical story of the law, the natural law, man who follows the law of God, of nature, turns out that's the only superhero you can actually become. Right? You can become like all the other characters in the Bible. You can become Abel, or you can become Cain. You can become Noah, which means at rest, or his three sons, which don't mean actual sons. It's not a genealogy. They're not real people. Each word, each name in the Bible has a different meaning of a state of being that each man will become, depending on your path, your parabolic path that you choose, right?
Today you're sleepy. Tomorrow you're doing this. The next week you're in the courts and you're the law guy. And the next week you're at the store, at the market, being the market guy. And
right, right. The purchaser kills the able-bodied man, so Cain kills Abel. It's all metaphoric, right? The one who becomes dependent on another is no longer Abel. It's real simple. Yeah, so Christ is it's like the one superhero in history that you can actually become. And that's the idea. So who benefits from causing you to believe that Christ was a real man who died for our sins on the cross and did all that stuff, right? Who benefits from causing you to believe that and to worship Christ and the fact that Christ is going to return? Right, he's going to return. Well, what that means is the Christ, the law will return. The Son, the Word, the law will return in man, and man will become Christ-like, will become sons of God. The Bible says that, we're to become sons of God, right? We're to follow the law, be Christ-like. But if I worship Christ as a supernatural man who's risen from the dead, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, instead of taking the allegorical legal meaning of that, which when you're a citizen, you're dead, and so he rose back into nature, he's born again back into nature, back into innocence, in other words, right? It only benefits the church, is what I'm trying to say, to have that as the belief system, to worship Christ as a God. Because then no man will ever become Christ-like, because Christ is now on a pedestal that you can't reach.
Sure. Now someone's arguing, well, I just don't know that the Bible is a good source for natural law. I mean, most of the people in there are still not getting it, you know. They're,
okay.
Put your logic before your grammar, your mind will be
Yeah, I mean, you know, in other words, they haven't read it in the original languages, looking it up in ancient Greek and Latin and Hebrew and understanding the words.
The thing is that you don't need to read it you don't need to read the Bible to find that out at all, actually. What you need to do is read the legal system, the legal law. Go to, I have William C. Anderson's 1889 Dictionary of Law here, okay? Defines Christianity. And it specifically says, Christianity is a part of the common law of Pennsylvania in the qualified sense that its divine origin and truth are admitted. I was talking about self-evident truth. It's undeniable when you see it, when you read it, and you're not, you know, confused about all the stuff that you've been taught. And here's what he says. He says, not Christianity founded upon any particular religious tenets. We're talking about what is the natural law or the common law. The foundation, I should say, of the common law. Once you bypass the foundation, then you get into the shit, the contracts and everything that really screws you up. You get into the legal side of the law once you leave the foundation or the natural source element of the law, right? Not Christianity founded upon any particular religious tenets, but Christianity with liberty of conscience to all men, right? All men are created equal, all persons are statuses and property of government. Persons aren't created equal. Citizens of the United States aren't created equal, my friend. But men, considering their creation of God, is again, you don't have to take this religiously. You just have to understand that means that we're self-evident beings in nature, right? The maxim does not mean that Christianity is an established religion, nor that its precepts, by force of their own authority, form part of our system of municipal law, nor that the courts may base their judgments upon the Bible, nor that religious duties may be penally enforced, nor that legal discrimination in favor of Christianity is allowed. In other words, it's not part of the written common law. It's considered the unwritten law, i.e. the Bible, right? The God's word, if you will, right? Again, metaphoric. Sorry. The best features of the common law with regard to the family and social relations, if not derived from, have at least been improved and strengthened by the prevailing religion and teachings of this sacred book. But the law does not attempt to enforce the precepts of Christianity on the ground of their sacred character or divine origin. Some of these precepts, though we may admit their continual and universal obligation, in other words, their self-evident, we must nevertheless recognize as being incapable of enforcement by human laws. Why is it the unwritten law? Because there's no sanction. Charity, love, peace. These things are able. You can't make laws except natural laws. You can't force people to love their neighbors and hate and love their enemies. Not their persons or their titles, but love your enemies as a man, not as a doctor or a lawyer, right? You can't force people to love. It's not part of the legal law because legal means anti-nature, anti-God. These precepts, moreover, affect the heart and address themselves to the conscious, while the laws of the state can regard the outward conduct only, for which reasons Christianity is not a part of the law of the land in any sense which entitles the courts to take notice of and base their judgments upon it. In other words, when you're in court in a legal situation, you have been banned from your access to God, i.e. the natural law. You are in a contractual situation. You're under the legal law, which literally means opposed to the natural law, opposed to God, opposed to everything that is equitable, right? Except so far as they can find its precepts and principles have been incorporated in and made a component part of the law. So the important foundational laws of the Bible are a big part of the, and are recognized as such as part of the common law, the very maxims or principles of law. And it's very clear that they come from the Bible. Okay? The maxim can have no reference to the law of the national government, since the sources of that law are the Constitution, treaties, and acts of Congress. All right. Now we call this a Christian nation. What the hell? This doesn't make sense because that means nothing about this nation, nothing about the states, nothing about the Constitution, nothing about the law of the land, nothing about treaties, and nothing, certainly nothing about coming out of Congress has anything to do with Christ or, i.e., the natural law. Well, no, it's a fucking commercial corporation. The only product government has is money, and we are considered resources, valuations in money. Our birth certificates are printed on frickin' banknotes, for God's sake. Mine says, think Midwest Banknote Company. So what this says is that at the foundation, at the source of our law in this country, the thing that you have been kept away from is the unwritten law, the law that can't be enforced. The choice that you have to remain pure, to keep your blood pure and not take the arms of the United States, the flag and the seal, which are the heraldic arms of the United States. It is your choice to follow the natural law, which comes from the Bible, that is very, very much admitted in all of these systems of law. And you choose instead to enter under the devil's contract, right? Devil can't do anything to you. Devil can tempt the hell out of you, but the devil can never do anything unless you sign his damn contract. Well, that's what citizenship is. And that's why they call devils or I should say attorneys, as devils. Agents are devils, right? Devil's advocates, right?
The devil master.
Yeah, it's, you remember that, man, in Scotland. That's the official name of attorneys, is devils and devil masters. Called deviling in Black's Forest. I mean, it's right there. You know, if I were to, again, go back to my main point, you cannot know anything unless you know its opposite. Well, I sat here and I studied the legal law and how corrupt and horrible it was, and I could never figure out why it was so horrible, why it was so degrading, and why it's all based on corruption of blood, attainder, and all these different concepts to keep us, you know, slave. I mean, this country was built on slavery. Let's not forget that, right? Only until I went over and said, oh, well, all roads seem to lead to the opposite of this, which is the Bible, the natural law, the God's law, the good stuff, right? All the stuff that we're supposed to be doing. And then all of a sudden, everything made sense. Everything came together, because for every legal law that I find the opposite in the Bible. Every fucking evil thing that I find in the legal system, I find the opposite. Or I find the warning in the Bible, the parable that says, if I become surety for another, I will surely smart for it. Smart means be put in pain. And sure enough, if I go to Title 42, Section 1981, it lists out my equal rights. What are my equal rights? To be put in pain, punished, taxed, licensed, and exacted, which means extorted from. All right? As a citizen of the United States, my right is to be extorted, to be put in pain, to be forced to have a license. Okay, these are my rights. You think rights are a good thing. No, rights are actually a bad thing, because they're legal rights. Natural rights are what are called negative rights. And that's why when you reserve all your rights from this legal system, you say, hey, you can't force me. There's no obligation, because I don't respect any of your persons that have any rights, because with right comes obligation. Well, I don't respect that person. I don't look at that person, because the Bible tells me in every chapter, do not respect the persons of men. The only way that law is going to apply to me is if I voluntarily respect and do business and contract and commerce with a fictional entity. Right? I'm telling you that every single thing that we do wrong is pointed out to us in the Bible, and it's called the legal fucking system. That's all I can say, man. You can take it for what it's worth. You can take the truth, or you can just continue on this path of absolute idiocracy that we're all being led on. I, for one, want to find people like you guys who actually want to take that step and get out of this system and not get to the 2030, Agenda 2030, where everybody's going to be marked with identity and have, you know, vain recognition, and you can't tell your person from your real self anymore. Right? I don't want to get to that point. I want to get out of this system before then. And I know that it's going to take like-minded people who are educated, I hate that word, but who have the knowledge of the natural law. I want to find those people, and I know those people want to find each other and myself. And that's my life now. Now that I understand this, I have no other goal in life but to find those people and help everyone else get to that point where you can create this utopian, if you will, society that the Bible talks about. Utopia just means the middle of nowhere. It means
rather than Aldous Huxley's dystopia that we're in now.
Exactly.
I'm into that.
You know where utopia comes from.
If I'm not for that, well, then you go right ahead. You're not who I'm looking for.
You know utopia comes from St. Sir Thomas More, who is like basically the god to all the communists and Fabians out there. Like, he's the creator of socialist utopias. So if you're looking for like the martyr of
dystopias,
the new,
you mean?
Yeah.
Sorry.
So if you're looking for the martyr for this antithesis, this evil, it's almost like St. Sir Thomas More, who's a constructed language creator, is tied to this, because he is very well admired by Karl Marx, Vladimir Lenin. I mean, a whole scope of people who are responsible for a lot of the carnage that we've witnessed and experienced, and our ancestors experienced in the last 100 years.
So one of the most important laws is never put your faith in men. In other words, never give liege fealty to any man. Always You know, you're always supposed to be respecting the God of nature.
You know, what do we always tell people, too? It's like, we're not trying to tell you what to think. We're trying to tell you how to think. You know, we're trying to empower you to be able to do this stuff on your own. It's not about, you know, us, you know, telling you. It's like people always ask me what I think, and it's like, here's the trivium, here's the tools. It's not about ad veracundium every chance you get, you know?
Well, and that's what I'm saying is, here is the ancient knowledge as I've found it. I'm not giving you my opinion here. I'm not telling you to put faith in me. I'm not fucking rewriting the Bible. I'm telling you what the Bible actually says. Don't put your faith in me. Don't look at me as a hero or an enemy. I'm not your enemy because I'm telling you the truth. That's another quote in the Bible, right? I mean, this is ancient knowledge. All I wanted was ancient knowledge. I wanted to be able to differentiate between what is knowledge and what is information. We're entering into the information age, right? We're in the information age. Information formation, right? In formation. There's no substance in information. The matrix is all information, right? Computer code, algorithms, all that. I want knowledge. And knowledge only exists. True knowledge can only happen in truth. What is truth? They say God is truth. What is God? Jehovah. Jehovah is all of nature, all of existence.
It's starting with realizing that there are no contradictions in nature and going from there.
Yeah.
You know?
If for instance, like you said, people check in and say, what do you think, Jan? And that's not the way you're supposed to go about it. What you do is you say, do you see what I see, Jan? You know, like, am I seeing reality? Do you see the same thing I am seeing? So instead of appealing to someone's authority on a matter, show them the information. Say, I see this. Do you see it? And then from that process, you can create a truth. If you both agree on it, there it is. It exists. Because we can see it. We can show it to others. They can see it. We can continue to reproduce this. So instead of appealing to people's authority, look into it.
Yeah,
right.
And as far as what true Christianity is, again, Christianity is not something, a word that I subscribe to or use, simply because there's nothing in the Bible that says become a Christian or become, you know, a member of some church. When you say church, you're actually talking about a people. When the Bible says this is the rock that the church will be built on, it's talking about people. You have to know what a rock is in order to know what its metaphor is, right? If you don't know what a rock is, that it's a solid foundation, then you can't get the metaphoric meaning out of it when it's talking about a bunch of people who are like-minded and following the same law, right? And Christianity, again, is defined in legalism as a system of doctrines and precepts taught by Christ. In other words, law taught by Christ, a religion founded by Christ. Christianity is said to be part of the common law. Okay, that's right out of the legal dictionary, which is right out of a judge's mouth. Christianity is said to be part of the common law. It's a parcel of the laws of England, and therefore to reproach the Christian religion is to speak in subversion of the law. That's 1889 dictionary again. The essential principles of natural religion. So we're talking about when you say natural religion, now you're getting to the point where you're again, what is the Bible, man? What is the worship of Jehovah? It's the worship of nature as one being, one God. That's you know, that sounds paganistic, but that's what the definition of God is. And here he's saying the natural religion. Who's the God of nature, right? A revealed religion, are part of the common law so that any person reviling or subverting or ridiculing them may be prosecuted at common law. So the law will not permit the essential principles of revealed religion to be ridiculed and reviled. Christianity is part of the common law of Pennsylvania, etc., etc. I mean, if you think about that, I would much rather live in this description of a society than what this hell that we've created on earth. And I want to be part of a society that why are the Jews, for instance, so damn successful? Because they follow the Talmud as their law. They worship that book as the law, not the Bible. No, their civil law is the Talmud. And they treat it as a holy book, even though it's fucking, it's filthy and it's evil. Right? But they admit very clearly that they follow that religiously, right? Well, back in this part of history, you were not welcome in this land that we call America in these states, in these towns, which were basically the churches were the government until the big government started moving in. You had these congregational churches that were the governments of these little, you know, colonies and shit. And you were not welcome there unless you were like-minded and you understood the law. And you know, there's no way that the kids of today and even the adults of today who just constantly tear apart the Bible, even though it's the foundation of their law, they don't even know it, right?
Right.
That would not have been allowed to happen in a society of like-minded people who might have been illiterate, but who know the law. They know that the Bible is the law. That's the difference between today and these years you're talking about when this country was being formed in colonies.
This guy, Stephen James, just missed the whole point. He was saying that, I don't know, throughout the whole show, we didn't provide any solutions. In other words, we didn't tell you what to think. We told you how to think and how to look at the information, and he wants to be told what to think and what to do. So he still hasn't caught up with the process yet.
Yeah, you want to know how to see, people are looking for a remedy. They want a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow.
Right. You know, it's like if you empower people and lift them up, you know, it's like if you teach somebody how to fish, you know, you're not handing them a fish and then making them the meal. You're showing them how to fish to take care of themselves for the rest of their life.
Yeah.
You know, we're not telling you what to think. We're showing you the process and how they manipulated things and the allegory that the Bible presents as natural law. And all Clint is doing is explaining that it's natural law so that you can go in, look it up in the ancient Greek and the Latin and the Hebrew and recognize that the natural law is there by looking the stuff up. We're not leading you into Christianity or to tell you to follow some religion. We're not telling you what to think. Oh, I get so tired of trying to explain this stuff ad infinitum. It's just like, wow, it makes me want to beat my head on a brick wall.
I'm afraid of the church at this point, now that I'm releasing this thing, I'm just destroying it. I'm utterly destroying it without any question. So, no, I don't want you to follow any religion. No, not what... That's the thing. Like I said, everybody's looking for that pot of gold, some remedy, some restitution, some... you know, the blacks want to be paid for their forefathers being slaves. The Mexicans want to be paid because this used to be their land. The Indians want to be paid because this used to be their land, right? Everybody wants some thing. Now you've got the white people who say, well, my family used to be landholders, and then somewhere along the line they got tricked into putting me into a birth certificate situation and taking away my blood right of inheritance. I want to be paid. Right now, everybody's in on the dang, I can't think of that word, restitution, or you know, everybody wants to be paid off for their trouble. And I'm telling you that money can never get you anything. Money will never get you happiness. It will never get you freedom. And money is debt. No matter how much money you have, it is property of government. Whatever is in your pocket is property of government. You have no money. There is no money. It doesn't exist. At least the value doesn't actually exist unless you believe in it, right? So there is no – all I'm telling you is that if you want to get out of this system and you want to have immunity, if you will, from this system of law, the only thing that this system of legal law recognizes is the follower of Christ. In other words, the follower of the natural law. He who does not participate in the contracts, the person, the oaths – all of this shit that we do on a daily basis, that is your ticket out of this matrix, this legal matrix, right? That's all I'm telling you. You follow the law.
You're saying, there's the door out of Plato's cave here. That's all you're saying, you know? You know, here's how you can see beyond the shadows. That's it. That's all you're saying.
It's been made so convoluted and complicated that when you hear words like, if I were to say, you know, you need to be born again. Scholarly, when I say that in a scholarly way, because I know what it actually means, I mean, it's a beautiful concept, but to most people, including myself a couple of years ago, I'd have been like, oh, God, I hate that. Oh, that's that Christian speak. I don't want to hear. No, all that means is to go back to what you originally were born as, right? You have, if you're pure blood, you haven't taken a name, a number, a mark, a sign. You have no identity that's recognizable.
Your PhD, et cetera.
You're getting rid of all the fiction, all the artifice. You're going back to nature. That's all it means. That's all it means. It doesn't mean that you have to suddenly bear a cross. The cross means nothing. In fact, I mean, the Catholic Church worships the death of Christ, not the life. I mean, they got
right.
Hanging up there like this, oh man. They love the death of Christ because then the Pope can say he's Christ. The Queen can say she's Christ, right? You can't do that. Christ was a man and he died.
What's that terrifying chair that the Pope sits on? Like, looks like just like death incarnate.
Right?
It terrifies me. Like, I remember
when I say the Pope is the Antichrist, the Bible says there will be many Antichrists. Most of the people listening to the show could probably qualify. I certainly qualify it as an Antichrist. It's a generic term. It's like God. You have to qualify it, right? What is an Antichrist? Someone who is opposed to the natural law. Right? That's all it means. Anti means to replace or to be in the stead of. Well, that's what vicar or vicarious means. He's the vicar of Christ.
Somebody is asking, so the New Testament is natural law that was laced with pacifism, et cetera. It's laced with fiction and with cover stories and with, you know, different groups and religions and this and that, adding to and trying to distort it and using different languages to cover up the original meaning, changing the words and what they meant. That's why you have to go back to the original.
Which is why I just spent a total of, I don't know, 10 years maybe, the last 3 or 4 years actually studying the Bible almost on a full-time basis, so that I could put all this information together so that you can finally get a fair shake at what the Bible says, so you can actually go and see what the words say straight out of Strong's Concordance, straight out of the lexicons and the, you know, the different, lexicons, concordances, and one other source. That's the point.
Sure.
The point is, I'm not saying take the Bible and read it as is, because it has been changed. It has been altered. I told we opened the show with the word God that it can mean 20 different things, and only very seldom is the actual true God or Jehovah, the word, actually used for the word God. Sometimes they use Jehovah, but for the most part, it's just God, 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 God. God did this, God raped, God pillaged, God did this. Oh, that God, he was a real bastard. You know, it doesn't make sense, really, when you think about that.
Yeah, see, you know, and this this person in here is commenting, you know, and then we're gonna let it go at this point. We're almost 2 hours. But let me just say one thing,
definitely.
But this person is saying that Satan is a figment of man's imagination. Satan is the false accuser,
Absolutely.
And Satan is, you know, what is keeping, you know, it's the lie on the left-hand path. It's that fiction that, you know.
All the word Satan means is that which is adversarial to reality.
Right.
That's all it means. It's adversarial to nature, adversarial to law, or i.e. Christ. It's adversarial. That's all it means. And yes, everything satanic comes from man. He's not meant to be some devilly horn guy down in the bowels of hell that you're going to split. That's stories told by the church. There's none of that in the Bible. When it talks about the underworld and the land, the realm of the dead, you got to understand you're under the Sesticuve Trust Act. You're considered dead as a citizen. A person who's not alive, you're spiritually dead when you're in citizenship to the state. You're acting as a person. Person is a status. A person has no substance, has no life. So you're considered dead, which is why you need to be reborn again into life. And guess what? There's no afterlife. The Bible doesn't talk about afterlife. It talks about life after death, because we are all right now spiritually dead following the law of the dead, the Sesticuve, right, which comes from 1666. You can read all about it in the book. You got to understand, you're in a dead trust. A mortgage is a dead pledge. A mortmain is dead.
Mortgage, dead.
Right? Yes, so you are dead in the spiritual, metaphoric way. That's why if you read the Bible, it sounds like a fucking zombie apocalypse. You got Lazarus coming from the dead. You got Jesus coming from... You got people coming back from the dead all over the place. That's because they're going back to nature, going back to God, going back to the natural law. That's all it means. It doesn't have to be complicated. It doesn't have to be...
Let's let Jacob get in his last point, and we'll... I mean, we've actually gone a full hour over tonight, so...
So we're talking about basically how the church is basically like the Antichrist. And you're talking about how different languages were kind of put into it to kind of cover stuff up, different stories. That was where Jan was going. And something popped in my head. And it had to do with the first interview I was on. I was talking about the Dayak tribes and their cannibalism and how when their religion returned to them, it was when the British allowed them to headhunt again. The religion returned. It was almost like they're able to do the communion. And that reminded me of, I was raised Catholic. And, one of the earliest memories that I have is actually screaming in church not to eat Jesus when they went up to the communion, because I felt it was so wrong that this beautiful man was going to be going up and everyone was going to eat him and drink his blood. I thought that was the sickest thing ever. And then we look at the cannibalism of Thomas Harrison and the studies that he did, and we look at how weaponized anthropology has this method of deconstructing and reshaping cultures and societies and histories. So it's almost like the Bible in and of itself could have been attacked. The stories were attacked. The allegories were attacked. And they were shifted and turned around in such a way that people were made opposed to it when really they probably should have returned to it. It's almost like the church itself is a cannibal eating Christ. The whole purpose of it is to be eating the culture, the sanctity, the divinity, the beauty, everything that it makes us wonderful and beautiful in life, what makes us men. It's almost like the church is there to cannibalize all of it.
Yeah, and they get everybody caught into this cannibalistic ritual of eating this allegorical man so that you're swallowing it down and shitting it out, right? So that you are killing and consuming the natural law, essentially.
And the Bible says the temple of Christ is within it. I might be misquoting that, Clint, but basically it's within. So if you're going to embody Christ, he's already inside of you. So why do you need to eat him? That doesn't make any sense at all.
And that concept is again, over and over. You are the body of Christ. You are to be Christ-like. You're not to worship an external thing. You're to embrace the internal, again, which is that unwritten, unspoken, unenforceable law. Your choice. You don't have to do it.
When you wake up and realize what the right-hand path is, it's kind of self-evident, I think.
Yes.
You know?
So you could say that Christ is the personification of the right-hand path. That's
exactly. Thank you. And you pretty much realize it right away when you begin to see the right-hand path. It's not about the religion itself, because the religion itself is mind control. It's about, it's just about trying to keep on the right-hand path and seeing all this stuff and, you know, and how you do it and, you know, trying to help and empower others rather than going, look what I can do, you know.
Well, and if you lived in this pure, in a state of pure love and charity all the time where, you know, the what's one of the laws of the Bible is that no man should be, you should not be wealthy unless all other men are wealthy. In other words, you know, if you're the strongest, you should be the servant, not the master, but the servant of all others. Right? It takes all of our, you know, the sports figure worship and the superhero worship, and it takes the superhero or the strongest man, and it puts him down here and humbles the strongest man, because the strongest man is the one that should be taking care of everyone else. Instead of the strongest man or the wisest man, if you will, creating an army and forcing everybody to pay him taxes. Right? That's the difference between, and the only way to get around that is, of course, to lose all conceptual, respect and value of money. You have to do it. Money is the root of all evil, specifically the love of money. And the word love actually translates to belief in.
See, you know what, Clint? I was thinking about this the other day. I think, you know, part of when they started getting rid of natural law, I think, was when they outlawed the duel and all of this stuff as well. You know, I think this is directly tied because, you know, if somebody was a false accuser, et cetera, you had the right to call them to a duel and handle it on a one-on-one basis, whether by sword or by gun, et cetera. And, you know, this was under natural law. So this is why, you know, everybody carried a gun on their hip and everybody, you know, people understood honor and all of this stuff. And you respected everybody and you only spoke nicely of people because you didn't want to be a false accuser unless you had evidence of this. Otherwise, they could draw you out and take you down, you know. So, anyway.
I'm curious about my name, actually, now that you brought up dueling. Because I studied a little bit of German in high school, a little bit in college. And I think there might be some people who speak German that are listening, so maybe they could correct me if I'm wrong. But when you look at the spelling, the anglicizing of my name, it's D-U-E. But in German, the UE, when I remember learning this, is supposed to actually be an umlaut, which would make it D-U-L-L. And that would reference back to Duliert, which would be like the dueling man would be my name, which I'm kind of curious about if that's actually correct or not.
Apparently your ancestor survived that duel.
Yeah.
Well, do you want that to be your name? Because, I mean, take it, dude.
I could, yeah.
That's, you're just talking about a legal surname. You can get rid of that.
Get rid of it and snake in the duel.
Your first name under law. This is not a choice that you have. This is what the law considers. Your first name is Jacob. That is your Christian name. They call it the God-given name, right? That is your name. In other words, it's your property, i.e. property of God, right? That's why the law can't touch anybody with just a Christian name. They have to make you attach your Christian, your good name, with a bad name, a legal name, a fiction, something from Satan, something that's adversarial to life, which is the dead name, which is the Dualman or Richardson or Irvin, right? And in that way, they call that the last name because the word last literally means that whatever is last is your last will and testament. Right? So by attaching your good name to the legal name, you're abandoning God or God's law or natural law or nature itself. You're becoming part of the fiction, a surety to a person, and you're literally thus bound by the legal law of persons because everything, you know, you're like a puppet master, your person, you carry around your person, right? And everything you do in commerce is, you know, you drive, everything is in person, right? In your name. And the law considers that to be a 100% of the time because you're under a what's called a social contract. And you know, I'm not saying that social contract is real or, you know, it's just the way the law works. I don't speak anymore as if, I always speak in the way a judge would speak or a judge of the law would consider. I always think of the maxims of law and I always say this is the way it would be or how it is. And there's no arguing against it because it's their system, not ours. We don't own it. We don't own the money. We don't own the law. We don't own the words. They're words of art. They're proprietary. They're property, right? So your name then becomes a legal fiction, an entity that belongs to government. And because it's property of government.
Under the franchise.
And you want all the benefits and all the stuff that comes with it, the shelter, the security, the protection. Forget liberty. Who needs that? Right? Then now you're stuck under that system of law. And so
then you want the cops to come to protect you instead of carrying the gun on your hip or whatever, and you're going to wait an hour, 3 hours for them to show up and, you know, with guns instead of taking care of your own business.
They're not there to protect you.
Right. They're protect the
landholders, the private people of the states that we're, right. You know, we're on a monopoly board. We can't own land. We're public persons of the United States. We're from a foreign country. We don't have any land as public persons. That's a whole other topic. But that does bring one other thing that I want people to consider and, is very much a part of the book, which is that the Second Amendment, when it says the right to bear arms, that does not mean guns. The reason it's capitalized or capital name, when a word is capitalized, it has a very specific meaning. The right to bear arms That's referring to your heraldry. It's referring to your bloodline.
Your coat of arms, and then you have the right to defend the coat of arms.
Well, exactly. So the notion of carrying a gun under the natural law is just a given. I mean, you're protecting your arms. You're protecting your family, your blood right to hold land. See, and that's people of the states, the private people, the landholders, they reserved their right, and they made sure that that was understood by the Second Amendment. We have the right to bear our arms. And what's so interesting is that the term, we've all heard the term original sin. Well, what is your origin? Your origin is from your mother and father, who are a bloodline, and at one point in time, they probably had heraldry just like everyone else. Original is the same word as ancestral. So original sin is ancestral sin. I'm giving up my family line, and I'm becoming part of the legal fiction, taking the arms of the United States. If you look up the arms of the United States, it's the seal and the flag of the United States. That's why when you go to court, you always see the American flag, the United States national flag, because you're literally no longer a son of God. You have no recognizable inheritable blood. You're now a son of the state. You're a person of the state. You have no blood. You cannot hold land. And you are required to pay all these taxes, and because you're always on the land of another. You're in a feudal state. You don't even know it. And the only way that you can know this is to first learn the legal law and then learn the Bible. And that's, again, why I put this whole collection together. And it's 5,000-6,000 pages, man. I'm just releasing the first 1140 or so.
It's like the new Dark Ages are in full swing already.
Oh, but you know, Jacob, it's funny you said that, because yesterday, and I was wanting to talk to you because, of course, and I've been wanting to bring this up, we've been going through all of Fomenko's work. And when you dive into Fomenko's work, you realize that we are in the Dark Age now. They call this the Information Age. But ironically, we are in a Dark Age. People have no idea how they're mind controlled and controlled, etc. You know, and you know, people really need to dive into Fomenko's books. And here's the thing: I think just on chronology, he's written over 100 freaking books.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the guy's got like, I mean, in the early 2000s, he had 187 books to his name. But I think just on chronology, he's got close to 100.
He's been doing this before we had these, you know, fancy computers and stuff.
So, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, he started in the night, you know, and, you know, if you go on Wikipedia, et cetera, the first thing you're going to read is that all of his work is pseudoscience and all this stuff. And then, you know, the smart ones will realize, you know, that's an appeal to ridicule and an ad hominem attack. And I'm just going to read the book for myself, or the books, and find out for myself. And then you go in and you start reading. It's like, wow, no wonder why they don't actually address any of his arguments, just like they don't address yours or mine or Jacob's when we present research, right?
So,
they always attack us rather than the work, because as soon as you get into the work and citations, you have, you know, serious trouble, because it all checks out. And then you're like, wow, you know, I mean, you know, it's he presents one topic in the chronology, and then later on, he on each like individual topic, he writes an entire book on it.
Yeah, you know? It's really cool the way he does that. It's fascinating.
I mean, yeah.
Wow.
I want to get you guys on a different track of thinking. You're going back to this term Dark Ages, right?
Well, no, he actually shows that the Dark Ages are another.
Yeah, but if you think about what that term means, remember everything it carries a metaphoric meaning, right?
Right. Okay.
So what does the Bible say? It says even, you know, Lucifer will present himself as the light.
Right.
Right? So when you say Dark Ages, you could also be saying just a complete buffoonery of illiteracy, which is what we are with the English language. We have this – we have information without knowledge. We have
it's like a bunch of books on the back of a jackass, right?
Spades in the light of illiteracy.
Useless fruit from the tree of knowledge. That was, you know, these are the concepts of man, the fruit that carries no seed. In other words, it's worthless information. So we're stuck in soap opera land. We love everything that is fictional and science fictiony, and but we never. Meanwhile, Monsanto's fucking rearranging the DNA of everything on Earth. Yeah. We're not paying attention, right? So think of it. Think of this as not the Dark Ages, but the Luciferian Age, which again, the Luciferians, as they call themselves, have literally taken hold of the United Nations, the whole thing.
They created it, because when you look at Aldous Huxley and Besant and all these people that were behind it, that's a direct creation of the Fabians, which is exactly what we've been exposing.
So it's not the Dark Ages, it's the ages of the false light.
Yes, they're bathing us in the false light.
Right. False knowledge. And I keep, we've done so much to expose with Hans Utter and the music, mind control and psychobiology, and with Steve Outram, et cetera. All of this, mind control and Luciferian Satanism stuff going on, but exactly right, Clinton. You have to grasp what the left hand path is and how they're doing this stuff. It's all about this communitarianism, and they package it all up in love and rights, and we have to gay rights and LGBT QWERTY rights and all of these and those rights, and it's all packaged in love, but each one is designed to strip rights and freedom away. Oh, we have to give cows rights. Well, if you give a cow a right, that means you lose the right to be able to nutrify yourself properly. What is, a vegan diet will put, women in menopause at about age 30. Your brain and body, are made of fat and cholesterol. Your reproductive system is made of cholesterol. Why are they selling this whole agenda? And you have to think, animals are cute and they have cute little faces and all, but you know what? When you start passing all of these rights and this right and that right, it's taking rights away. You're not lifting animals up to the level of man. You're pushing man down to the level of animal. And you have to get the trick. Kabbalists always flip. They always flip. You have to flip it back,
Clint, do you have that quote from Horace Greeley handy about when Lincoln freed the slaves and he, instead of lifting everybody up, he quoted them as bringing everybody down to the level of serfdom?
The great thing about this on this PDF that I am shooting out to everybody, like you said, download it for free, is that you can simply type in a term and search for Greeley while you're asking me, and there it is right there.
Boom.
I mean, I use this document, the 5,000 page document, for my radio shows because I know the names of the quotes, and I mean, I'll pull up crap all the time from this document instead of going to the internet because I know I already researched it. And once you get used to this document, you can do the same thing. You can pull these things up. This is my gift to you, we have stricken the slave shackles from 4 million human beings and brought all laborers to a common level, not so much by the elevation of former slaves as by practically reducing the whole working population, white and black, to a condition of serfdom. While boasting of our noble deeds, we are careful to conceal the ugly fact that by an inequitous money system, we have nationalized a system of oppression which, though more refined, is not less cruel than the old system of chattel slavery.
If you juxtapose that with his quote about the Bible and how you can't enslave a Bible-reading people, exactly. I mean, that's just huge.
I made a point about this on Facebook last week because, and I had posted a quote, I forget what it was now, but when you see the promotion of all of this new age religion and the neo shamanism and it's mind control in and of itself, but then what this allows to happen is people are then moving away from natural law and then they can be enslaved, so.
Right. That's the recipe. That's what I'm trying to get.
Exactly.
That's the simplest way of putting it. Thank you. I would like to ask you guys a favor, since you're on this road already, and
there's three of us on this road.
We're doing a vaccine documentary because I need a break from the book for a while, and so we're going to try to get all of Patrick Jordan's list together, who help him research, and try to meet up in a single place and just let everybody have an internet connection and just basically pull down all the videos and all the studies and everything in one sitting, and then I can just go through it and make a movie out of it, basically, once we do all that. And that way the audience, everybody is connected and able to do the work themselves, right? I would like to ask the same thing of you and your audience here, because it is my opinion, and it's just my opinion. I'm asking you to prove my opinion, and I'm not saying this is the way it is, but it's my opinion that this is the whole purpose of what we call secret societies, which technically are just societies of their own secrets, right? When you talk about, for instance, Captain Morgan, who wrote a book, and he was executed for exposing the Freemasons' top secrets, which is that they had no secrets, that everything they held secret was basically fiction, and that there are no real secrets, and then all it is really organized crime. Hey, Judge, I'm a Mason, fellow brother, please let me off. Oh, yeah, no problem, right? So what I think is that secret societies, all of these different things, have to do with exactly what you're talking about, which is to hide the secret that history has been rewritten and kept in vaults like the Vatican and other places. And then you've got all these...
Why they destroy the Alexandrian Library, etc.
The whole purpose of secret societies is literally to keep the secret that there is no history as they've portrayed it, and that they're keeping the secret of falsified history, if you will. That's my basic premise, and you know, wherever that goes from there is fine. That's what it seems to be, because you know, everything they worship is something of their own creation.
I would agree with you. I'm just trying to find that quote here. It looks like it might be down my page ways, but I'm probably getting close to it. Okay, so what I wrote here is, this is probably why we see such heavy promotion of New Age religion, neo-shamanism, neo-paganism, the archaic revival et al., slavery. I've been thinking about this for a couple of years, and this article confirms it. And this is from the McCleary Report, I think. Quote, just 5 years later, Nicholas V legalized the enslavement of African infidels, with the result that human trafficking profits, quote-unquote fees, continuing to go to the Catholic Church. He issued Dum Diversus on the 18th of June, 1452, authorizing King Alfonso V of Portugal to, quote, attack, conquer, and subjugate Saracens, pagans, and other enemies of Christ, wherever they may be found.
Christ being either the Pope or the King.
Well, sure, but, you know, at the same time, the idea here is that anybody who is not a Christian, they are free for slavery, for killing at all. So, you know, while, of course, they're using it in definition for the Pope, we can see, you know, the true meaning of this. And it says, what this means, any non-Christians were now reduced to the status of slaves.
So, and that is what Horace Greeley says in the other quote of his, which is basically, like you said, a Bible-reading people cannot be enslaved. And that's coming from an insider, a private person. You know, when you hear that quote that we just read from Horace Greeley, you can tell that he's talking as one of the elite. He's not putting himself in the place of a worker or a slave. He's talking about a different class of people, a lower class of people. And he was writing that to President Lincoln, by the way. All right. So you got to consider that when he says things like that, he's talking from a place of knowledge that is far superior to yours or mine, because he's part of that upper echelon of, you know, he was the editor, chief editor and owner, I think, of the New York Press or something like that. I mean, he was a big wig. And so you got to consider that these guys know what they're talking about. And so anyone that's not, when he says Christian, what he really means, anyone that's not following the law, anyone that has been tricked into our legal system is a slave. Anybody that's been tricked into taking any person or identity or property of another will become the agent of that principal owner of that property. That's what he's saying. He's not saying, well, you're not a member of the local Coda church, and therefore you are a sinner. No, he's saying you're not. They're not following the law. That's all he's actually saying.
All right, that's probably a great spot to wrap up. Anyway, Jacob, thanks for coming on. You still don't have a website. You'll probably have one soon, right?
I probably should. People have been inquiring about that. I probably should get something set up and start writing my ideas down, because I've learned a lot in this last month. It's been an adventure. Really cool. A lot of fun.
All right. And, Clint, your website's Reality Blogger. Isn't that spelled differently?
I haven't used that for a while, but, yeah, Reality Blogger with a 1G .wordpress.com. And I'm going to put up a high-quality PDF of my final book as it will be printed, and will be printing in June. But the free PDF, free to anybody who wants it, will be posted next week at strawmanstory.info.
Great. And is there any place where people can donate to you, Clint?
It's on the Strawman Story website.
All right.
And you know, that's it's all explained on there.
Yeah. All right, and please support Gnostic Media, GnosticMedia.com. Of course, we can't do it without listener support. We're not here pushing commercials and products in your face, so we need your help, you know. And
love money.
We need money to pay the man for the electricity and the computer equipment and the stuff that we're contracted for. So
it's a horrible feeling.
Yeah. Anyway.
Books. Oh my goodness, the books.
And there's stacks of books everywhere around here. So, all right, gentlemen, thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen of the audience, thank you so much for participating in the chat group. Until next week, see you then. Clint, we're gonna have to have you back soon. Take care. Goodbye, everybody. Good night.